Psalm 19 in part. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their line goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And then on that last Gerard Hopkins has a poem. It's a bit hard to follow, but I'm going to read the whole poem anyway because it's short. And then I'm going to go back and take one little part of it and go over that again. Ribblesdale is the name of this one. It's a sonnet. I think it's a sonnet. Eight lines and then six lines. Is that a sonnet?
Yes.
Earth, sweet landscape with leaves throng and louched low grass. Heaven, that dost appeal to, with no tongue to plead, no heart to feel, that canst but only be, but dost that long. Thou canst but be, but that thou well dost. Strong thy plea with him who dealt, nay, does now deal. Thy lovely dale down thus, and thus bids reel thy river, and o'er gives all to rack or wrong. And what is earth's eye, tongue, or heart else? Where else but in deer and dogged man? Ah, the heir to his own self-breadth so bound, so tied to his turn, to thriftless reeve both our rich round world bare, and none wreck of world after. This bids wear earth brows of such care, care and deep concern, care and dear concern. Excuse me. I almost think he read Psalm 19 and then wrote this sonnet. Earth, he says, with no tongue to plead, no heart to feel, that can but only be. And yet, that thou well dost, strong thy plea with him who dealt. That is with God. And then he says, what is earth's tongue, eye, tongue, or heart, elsewhere else but in deer and dogged man? And then he says, this air, to thriftless reeve. To reeve means to, I think, I should have looked it up to be sure, but I think it means to tear, take apart, or destroy. To thriftless, without thrift. To thriftless reeve both our rich round world bare, and none wreck of world after. We don't, when we're doing this, we are not thinking of the world that's coming. This bids wear earth brows of such care. Care and dear concern. And one of the people who's concerned is Wendell Berry. And that's where I got the title for this session, The Unsettling of America. What I want to do is communicate the whole book to you. And of course I can't do it because, first of all, I don't have it all in my own head, and even if I did, there wouldn't be time or ability to get it through to you. So hopefully the clock will be bossy enough to prevent me from wearying you over my head. But he is he's a fine writer. He's written novels and poems as well as this book, and so he can write. And so he's got not only good ideas, but he's got a nice way of putting them. I want to share a few things, and then from time to time I'll stop and find out whether you all are with me or whether I'm wandering out somewhere in the skies with no company. First, I wanted to do a thing. I was hoping we'd have more here, but this will work anyway. How many people here now live on a farm? Anyone? No one. How many have lived on a farm? Ever? Yeah, I have too. How many of you had parents who were on the farm? Yeah, now we got three. Or grandparents that you know? Yeah, same. No more, huh? Okay. I wanted a larger sampling because I thought that if we went back far enough, we'd find a lot of connectedness.
So,
that's fine. Come in.
We were reading the three letters of Wes Preeb, and we couldn't
stop
until we had read them. Yeah,
that's right. I just took a poll, and so since you two have come in, I want to know whether you've ever lived on a farm.
No.
No? Parents lived on the farm, maybe?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, one more. We obviously, our culture was once very agricultural, and now it's obviously not. And he, in the book, deals with that all the time. He says, he quotes that 96% of our people now do not live in the country. So that's the kind of trend. And it's happened quickly. It's happened really very quickly. He wants to talk about things like wildness and how we live with it. His position is not simple. He's not saying we have to get more land and put it aside and not touch it. In fact, he's very careful about realizing that most of the earth we're going to have to use. And so he says, if we're going to use it, then we better know how we're using it and quit ignoring the fact that we are using it. In fact, he's hard on conservationists who, on the one hand, want to tuck aside a parcel of land and say, this we won't touch, this is wilderness, but at the same time ignore what their life, how their life requires the use of the earth. All of us, I mean, by the clothes we wear and the food we eat and the machines we use, implicitly are using the earth. Those things came from the earth. We all use the earth. And he says that because we don't live where we work, we are able to ignore oftentimes how it is that we are using the earth. I mean, the car that I drive and the metal in that car, I don't happen to live near a mine. I don't happen to live in a factory town. So the results of the labor and so on and the materials that made that car come into being are not being pressed upon me. I grew up in South Dakota. The air was relatively clean. I grew up on a farm, not in a mine, see? So I can kind of ignore. I mean, I can drive, and I did, believe me. Boy, I wanted my dad to buy a new car all the time, you know? And I could ignore the results of that. And that's just one little example. But the time is coming, you know, and we're not going to be able to ignore the results. Even the very rich people can hardly get away from the results of what we're doing to the earth, this thriftless tearing of the earth. He's got a lot of ways that he comes at this. This is one that I want to use at the beginning simply because I don't know how to tie it in any other way, so it sort of has to be at the start. He underlined a statement here. He says, the natural forces that so threaten us are the same forces that preserve and renew us. He wants to speak about wildness as something which we cannot live outside of. We cannot. He said, we are striving for control. And we imagine that when we get everything under control, then we'll be fine. But he said, you know, he wants to point out that life is this process, this cyclical process. In another place, he talks about the topsoil, and he says the soil is both fantastically alive, full of all kinds of organisms, of earthworms, of bacteria, plants coming up, seeds are lying in the soil waiting to grow, and yet at the same time, the soil is most obviously a grave. Many things die and fall into the soil, and those two things have to be happening together. Or the soil becomes a dead thing, and then we simply mine it. And he would say that our farming right now these days tends to be a mining procedure. And I've heard farmers talk that way, speak about people who mine the soil. You know, you pour a bunch of chemicals on it and a bunch of minerals, you plant the stuff in there, and then you take it out and you haul it away. You take it and you haul it away to make food for humans out of it. Or you take it and haul it away to feed animals. But then the waste, what we call the waste from that procedure, is not put back on the land. It's wasted, precisely what we call it. We lose the cycle. We want to be outside of the cycle because we are our death deniers. We don't want to think about this cycle because we specifically do not wish to be in the cycle. We wish to be immortal. And so our lives and our culture reflect that. The natural forces that threaten us, the same fungus that wants to eat me up, starting with my feet, you know, and causes a lot of itching and problem, that same kind of a process is needed in the world. No, it won't do to try to get rid of it. Bacteria are friends as well as enemies. He's got a neat statement in here somewhere else, he says, we've gotten the germs out of our food, all right, and replaced them with poisons. This is a miracle of modern science and hygiene. The natural forces that threaten us are the same forces that preserve and renew us. And he says, if the farm is to last and remain in health, the wilderness must survive within the farm. That is what agricultural fertility is, the survival of natural process in the human order. Jim did the parables, you know, he said, the sower goes out and sows. He plants the seed, it comes up. He doesn't know how. He can't make it come up, but it comes up without his efforts. It just grows and it produces the crop. We're surrounded by these natural processes, but somehow we want to get in there and control them. We want to make them better. Hopkins has got another poem, which I didn't read, where he says that even when we try to help the process, we end up harming it. It was made without us. We didn't make it, but we do have to use it, and we're a part of it. And the problem comes when we try to be what we're not, which is immortal gods with infinite hungers, and we suppose we have the right to satisfy those as we might, as best we might. That's by way of a footnote. Some of that stuff will come back around again. One other thing in the back here before I start at the beginning. He says, our connections are broken. This is this by way of this cycle again. The cycle, everything is connected to everything else. You know, I remember in grade school science, we looked at the water cycle, for instance. You know, water evaporates, goes up, becomes clouds, precipitates, comes down on the soil, then there's runoff into the streams into the ocean, and it evaporates, and round it goes, you know. Water, unless if we take it apart by hydraulic, what's the word for breaking water into hydrogen and oxygen?
Hydrolysis,
yeah. Unless we take it apart, it's preserved. It doesn't go away. It just moves from place to place. And that's the way it all is, right? I mean, the earth is here, and it just keeps on shifting around and changing. But it doesn't go anywhere. And we're not going anywhere. You know, we're just a part of this movement, see? And another place he says, that's what infinity is about. It isn't talking about the immeasurable increase of quantity. I mean, the earth is not getting larger, probably. I don't know, maybe stuff is coming in and making it larger, but maybe some of it is slewing off too. I'm not that much, but essentially the earth isn't getting larger, it's just moving around. And it's always moving, and we're part of that movement. So he says, only by restoring the broken connections can we be healed. Connection is health. And what our society does its best to disguise from us is how ordinary, how commonly attainable health is. We lose our health and create profitable diseases and dependencies. By failing to see the direct connections between living and eating, eating and working, working and loving. In gardening, for instance, one works with the body to feed the body. That's a tight cycle, see? Now he goes on to talk about gardening. The work, if it is knowledgeable, makes for excellent food, and it makes one hungry. The work thus makes eating both nourishing and joyful, not consumptive, and keeps the eater from getting fat and weak. This is health, wholeness, a source of delight. And such a solution, unlike the typical industrial solution, does not cause new problems. Now, at the beginning of one of his chapters, he quotes James E. Bostick, Jr., former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Rural Development. Rural development, right? And this is what Mr. Bostick said. But just stop for a minute and think about what it means to live in a land where 95% of the people can be freed from the drudgery of preparing their own food. This is stated as a positive thing, see? This is a plus. This is something we're proud of. Now he wants to say something. Now he's talked about gardening. Now he goes on. The quote, drudgery, unquote, of growing one's own food then is not drudgery at all. If we make the growing of food a drudgery, which is what agribusiness does make of it, then we also make a drudgery of eating and of living. It is a sacrament, the growing of food, he says. It is a sacrament, as eating is also, by which we enact and understand our oneness with the creation.
I think that is just terribly powerful stuff. I'll stop there because I feel like I've been talking already for half an hour. Does anybody want to say anything? Does that come through at all? Is there a sufficient unity in my presentation? What do you want to say?
Thank you, Senator. It's powerful. Thank you.
I'll go on. Interrupt me. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, just curious. I don't know if you want to deal with this. I mean, what kind of a background does this very come out of? I mean, what kind of a point of view does he start out with? In terms of, perhaps just in terms of the church. I mean, is he interested in the church?
Yes, I think so. He affirms the biblical witness and the church tangentially. I mean, he doesn't come right in and state it, but he takes little quotes. He quotes Isaiah in one place, "Woe to those who add field to field, you know, until they're all alone in the land." I made some notes of little references. And then at the end of the book, he uses the Amish as an example of the way to use the land responsibly. And he says, this is Christian use of the land. This is the way Christians live in the land, truly. So he affirms it pretty strongly. That's at the end of the book. He's not Amish. He lives on a farm in Kentucky, says the book. In the beginning, he thanks his wife for helping him hold household together while he's out, you know, writing books and going around the country, I suppose, promoting it or whatever. It's in kind of a strange position, but I don't know a lot more about him than that. I haven't read his novels or his poems.
Do you think he would see similarities with the Native American Indian culture, the wholeness of belonging to the land and using it in the way the Indians have?
Yeah, I'm sure he would. He only speaks of the Indians in passing as one of the victims of what's happening. He says what happened to them is they became dependent on manufactured goods. We came in and we had guns and we had fancy knives and other things, and they began to depend on those things. And that's how they got to be subservient to us. And he said that's a parable. Not just history, but it's a parable. He says, because we're all dependent upon what is manufactured. I'm coming to that now. I think that will tie in. We'll continue on with something. He said, you know, he talks about gardening and the benefits of gardening. He says, there's nothing more absurd, to give an example that is only apparently trivial, than the millions who wish to live in luxury and idleness and yet be slender and good-looking. We have millions, too, whose livelihoods, amusements, and comforts are all destructive, who nevertheless wish to live in a healthy environment. They want to run their recreational engines in clean, fresh air. So true. Then he says, there is now, in fact, no benefit that is not associated with disaster. That's because we've taken everything apart, see? He says, power can be disposed morally or harmlessly only by thoroughly unified characters and communities. The Indians had lived for so long in the same way that they had to deal with the results of what they were doing. And besides, they didn't spread out. I mean, that even the largest Indian tribes comprised only maybe 3,000 or 4,000 individuals. That's a small town in South Dakota. No, that was their whole population. They had a lot of room, but they were limited in other ways, and they had to deal with what they were doing. We don't have to, we think. He says, here is a Christian, one of his little biblical references. He says, we have tried to escape the sweat and sorrow promised in Genesis, only to find that in order to do so, we must forswear love and excellence, health and joy. If we wish to escape God's warning to us that our bread will be produced by the sweat of our brow, then we also must give up the benefits of God, the love of God, the grace of God, in excellence, in health, and joy, because we've denied that characteristic of reality. We cannot escape that. He has a comment on the energy crisis.
He says, the basic cause of the energy crisis is not scarcity. It is moral ignorance and weakness of character. Nuclear power, if we are to believe its advocates, and I want to make a footnote. I don't think all of its advocates are saying this, but some perhaps are. Nuclear power, he says, is presumably going to be well used by the same mentality that has devalued and misapplied man and woman power. If we had an unlimited supply of solar or wind power, we would use that destructively too for the same reasons. What he's saying is that getting more power is not going to make us better people. He says, we might get all that. We might get all that. We might. But, he says, it cannot define what is desirable. If gasoline is cheap, I will continue to drive my car, even though I know it's destructive. I've got a car down a 25-mile creek, and it's a gas hog at that. It's not even an economical car. As long as I can afford gasoline, I'll probably drive that car. He talks about how difficult it is to live in this society and not to be a part of the bad processes. In fact, I think he would say it's impossible. So there's no point in us becoming just totally guilt-ridden about it. I can't be free and you can't be free of it. But he says we need to begin to think about it. And some people, he says, are thinking about it, and that's a plus. So much of the time, I think, if we become totally guilt-ridden, then we try to find the quick solution. If I'm guilt-ridden about what I'm doing, then I might become a fanatical conservationist. And if I manage to successfully see to it that the wilderness area down the road here, you know, we've got one. Just up the road here is a wilderness area. You can't take any motorized things in there at all. And that's fine. And he approves of that. But if I somehow can manage to get that enlarged or get another one, then maybe I won't feel guilty anymore. But then that won't make me any more honest because I'm still using the world, see? I'm still using the earth. And I can't escape that. That's my human condition. And if I don't know enough to grow my own food, then I'm going to have to eat food that someone else grew. And maybe I'll choose to learn how to grow my own food, but in the meantime, I still have to eat, and so do you. We can't escape it, but we can begin to think about it. And I would, as a Christian, say that I can afford to do that because the cross says to me something about how the world is not as it should be. And the price has been paid. The ultimate price has been paid. And so I don't have to tear myself apart trying to justify my life. Not with regard to the earth either. But that doesn't free us from thinking about it.
Is he advocating that everybody should grow their own food then? That would be an impossibility. We have to depend on large farms and one production feeding a number of people. The world started out with the people. I mean, the world started out with the Lord's intention, like you said in that book, Raise Your Own Food by the Sweat of Your Brow. But with the increase in population, it's impossible. We have to use it the best we know how.
He addresses that. And the answer is not a quick answer. He says several things. One thing, he said, we talk about freeing people from drudgery, for instance. But he says, what are they freed for? He said, people are freed from, he's got an example in here. There was an article in National Geographic and talked about where agriculture is going. And then they had one picture of a family, and the picture was captioned, When Machines Replace People, and dealt with this family called the Anderson family. They're a large family, 9 children or something like that. They live in this little shanty. And the Mr. Anderson used to work in the cotton field for $2.50 an hour. And it was hard work. It was hot, sweltering work. Well, now, machines have come in and they're doing the same work that he used to do. So he's been freed from that. He's been freed to move into the city and be unemployed. See, is what he's been freed for. And so he's saying, here our cities are loaded with unemployed people. On welfare rolls, on scrounging around to try to have a life. in the country is a lot of what we call marginal land, for example, that has been abandoned because it cannot be farmed by the methods, by the big methods. Large tractors can't get into them, for instance. Those same people would be able to make a good, decent living on that land. But that's not the direction we're going. So that's one thing.
That would put some people to work, but it wouldn't employ everybody.
Okay, right. He doesn't, I'm sure that he doesn't believe that everyone will raise their own food. He says, it, for as far back as we can see, it wasn't like that. Because some there are some jobs that need to be done, you know, where that are going to require enough of your time so you can. But he talked about the time when there were more people on the farm, and the farmers did sell their produce, but the town people had a garden. They didn't have to buy everything. Maybe if they were in a situation where they couldn't raise their own cattle, they bought their beef, but they raised their own tomatoes. It's a process. I mean, if you live in a high rise, you've got no place to grow a garden. You can't do it. And not everybody's going to be able to move out of the high rises right away because there wouldn't be any place for them to live. So I think he's talking more about directions than he is about any solutions. No? But the thing is that we're not really moving toward solutions. A few people know about, you know, growing a garden, and gardening for a while became a kind of a thing again. I know some people that hadn't had gardens for a while began to have gardens again, where that was possible. But then he quotes, for instance, one of the thrusts of his book is to show that our Department of Agriculture and all the people who presume to be speaking for the agricultural practices of the country are all pushing more and more for larger and larger. Like when I was just home now, my dad used to be a farmer, right? And he talked about a new tractor that's coming out. I forget how big it is. I mean, it's just a monster. And the machinery is all going in that direction. If you try to talk to someone about farming with a horse or a mule, you're probably going to be laughed at. And yet he's saying in here that there's land that can be very well farmed with a horse or a mule. And could support people. And it's just sitting there now. It's not being used. But where are the people who are saying, wait, we've got this, you know, we've got to turn around? I don't think you're going to find it in the newspaper. Yeah?
One of the things with our economic conditions as they stand right now, if where do we head with all, you know, when people accumulate and with inflation being as strong as it is, you know, where is the answer at this point? One of the answers would be to do exactly as he says, because in Germany years ago, you know, just to mail a simple little postcard would cost you millions of marks. And people will say, well, we're not going to head that way. We're headed darn strongly that toward that same type of condition. And what happens then? Then this land that you're talking about here could very easily be supported and in time gained. And that might be one of the answers which nobody is. You know, they talk about going into gold and into silver and all these other things. But by the same token, you know, not everybody can do that either. Nor does everybody have the knowledge to get involved in these things. And yet the simple answer, this is your statement in reality.
I think the problem will be if you want to get people back on the land to raise their own food, is you're going to have to talk them into it. Because the trend has been away. The trend has been towards the cities and all the conveniences we have. And how are you going to turn these people around? I don't want to be turned around and said, you go back to the farm and raise your food. And
too many people also like the easy life, their own welfare, they yes. don't have to work, and their children have seen their parents do it, and they also feel, well, why should I go to work and earn my own living? When my parents didn't have to do it, so it just comes to me, it's given to me. Mm-hmm. And there's no thought of going out and, you know, doing doing something to help themselves as people either.
His comment, you know, on how we all want to be slender and good-looking, but we also want to sit around and not do anything all day, I thought is particularly appropriate. I mean, people in cities have to find places where they can run in order to maintain some kind of health, because the natural flow of our lives is not causing us to be active, and brings a host of problems, I'm sure. I'm saying this in the presence of a doctor who knows a lot better than I do, but, you know, I'm sure that's true. He talks about how we hate and have hated the idea of physical labor. I grew up on the farm, and I couldn't wait to get off the farm to escape having to throw hay bales in 100-degree weather in June. I mean, I'd come home from school, and the first thing would be haying season, and, you know, there's those 75-pound alfalfa bales, and they're just misery. I couldn't wait to get off the farm. And dirt, you know, and scratchy barley beards down your back and everything. I bought it, hook, line, and sinker. You know, the desire to be able to stay clean and not to have to be sweaty. But you know, the thing is, now we have to go looking for places to get sweaty. That's the crazy part of it. You know, I mean, it's approved to be a runner, but if you're out laboring in the field hoeing something or other, then that's drudgery. We're split. Our minds are divided. Yeah. And he talks about education, too, is fostering that. He talks about labor saving. He's got a neat thing. He says labor can't be saved. Can't save it. Machines do the work for us, but labor can't be saved. Labor, I mean, to work is a process. If you don't do it, it simply doesn't happen. Labor-saving devices eliminate. They replace us. Machines are replacing us, but they are not saving anything, really. They're really they're very expensive. They're a large expenditure. Every machine that we use doesn't save. It spends. It spends materials. It spends fuel to make, you know, the machine, which then becomes a pollutant. Every time that labor is saved, it's a huge expenditure, because precisely this idea of the gardening and the use of our labor is the kind of thing, the kind of energy use that is non-destructive. But it can't be saved. You've got to use it, so in order for it to be there. Otherwise, it isn't used. It's wasted. So, you know, but we bought, you know, that phrase, labor-saving device.
Well, at least labor, those that produce labor-saving devices, that gives employment to people. Not like people that work in factories building, well, washing machines, which is a labor-saving device, and it takes labor to make those things.
Yes. You know, without, I couldn't, you know, there'd be, you'd have to look at that statistically, and I don't have that kind of
well, I know it
scope.
Might be not as much labor as to go out and do the stuff. It doesn't employ as many people.
Right.
But it does require some labor.
Yes, it does. But as you say, it's less, you know. I mean, we're going in that direction. You can just tell by looking around. I mean, they're just, people aren't working, right? A lot of people aren't working. A lot of people are working at useless jobs. I had a hard time justifying being a janitor at a Coca-Cola plant in Minneapolis, because does the world need Coca-Cola, really, you know?
Some people think they do.
Well, yes, I know. The dentists probably need it, because, you know, then that makes your teeth rot away and gives them something to do. And that's what he means when he says that we have profitable diseases. There is a kind of this is making us money. A lot of us are making money from this process of destroying of the earth and of our health. Not just doctors, for heaven's sake. I mean, all of us are. Let's put it that way. I mean, we're in a money economy. He's got some startling statements in here. He says, the modern home is the most wasteful, the bastion of wastefulness. How does he state it? It's just amazing here. When I read it, I thought, how can he say that?
The modern home, even more than the government and universities, has institutionalized the divisions and fragmentations of modern life. With its array of gadgets and machines, all powered by energies that are destructive of land or air or water, and connected to work, market, school, recreation, and so on by gasoline engines, the modern home is a veritable factory of waste and destruction. I mean, you know, we want to praise the home and save the home, and he's saying as presently constructed, it's terrible. He talks about, and this is where I got stopped. He says, people used to live where they worked. So European farmers lived upstairs at a barn. True, huh? Mm-hmm. And he said, not every home was the same then. It didn't look the same and it didn't smell the same. Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up on a farm and I know what some of those smells are. And you know, you say, well, do I want to live that way? No.
But the modern housekeeper today has an incinerator.
Yes.
And all of her garbage goes down into the sewer.
That's right.
And in our day, we buried it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it didn't hurt us.
Mm-hmm. But now it's a problem.
Yeah.
How do you haul it away? Where do you put it?
Yeah, you're right. In the cities, they don't have room for it. Almost every large city has the problem of where is the garbage going to be dumped.
And of course, getting the people out of the city and back on the land would do two things. It would help that problem too,
mm-hmm.
because you'd simply have less people there, where they've got nothing to do anyway.
But then you come along with some of our conservationists, and I read in a book, I don't know where I read it, but about the farms back in the Middle West, and about the manure from the farm being scattered on the farm. And then the rain washing it into the Platte River, and that in turn running into the Missouri River, and all the contamination.
Mm-hmm.
So do away with that.
The largest problem with that are the large livestock operations where they've got 10,000 cattle, you know, in a few square miles or something like that. There's a if you drive, let me see, you're driving along the Columbia. I have to get my directions straight. South of Wenatchee, you come by one of those cattle operations. Do any of you live in this area or have occasion to drive down there? Greg, probably. Well, there's one by Ellensburg, too. Yeah. This one here is one just not too far south of Wenatchee. It's right on the Columbia River. And they're in these pens. And, of course, there's not a green thing in there. I mean, they're packed in there. See, the manure from those animals is a pollutant. It's a pollutant. And because they're all packed in this tight little area, you know, the soil can't accommodate that much.
No.
So it does wash away and become a pollutancy. In the meantime, the farmers in the surrounding area are buying fertilizer from corporations who are making a lot of money supplying that fertilizer. And then there's probably another company that's making money trying to figure out a way to get rid of that polluting manure. He says we've done the neat thing of taking a solution and dividing it into two problems.
But they call that progress.
Yes.
Well, we had this fertilizer that we used to buy called Milorganite. And it was made in Milwaukee from Sioux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With there? The addition of other chemicals.
Yeah, there is some some work being done.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, and he's saying we've got to begin to think a lot more seriously about it. Yeah. He's got a neat idea in here on what he calls, he says that he talks about the future. And I thought it accurately reflected some things. I'm not sure that the future is such a big thing as it once was, maybe even 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And he comments on that too. I have to back up a little bit to get a background here. Yeah, the chapter where he begins by talking about the modern home and what a problem it is. Then he goes on to say, when people do not live where they work, they do not feel the effects of what they do. The home is separated from everywhere else, and so, among other things, it lives in ignorance. He says, when you're sitting in front of your TV in your living room, how can you really question that everything is really going all right? It is for a while, but
But where the pinch is going to come, he says, is in the future. Hopkins says, we don't reckon the world after, see? Now he said, he gives a background of how this came to be. He said, when explorers came to this country, they saw, what, natural resources. That's what they saw, including the people. Slave trade began right away. The people who lived in the country and all the things that were here were seen as this tremendous bank full of natural resources, you know, and we have the right to use them. See, you put a flag there and you say, we claim this country for France, England, Spain, whatever, and now it's ours, and we're going to use it. And the least regard we had was for the culture that was already here, obviously. They went away a long time ago. He said that that sovereigns used to be thought to be below God and above the people, to the king and the nobles. You know, they ruled the common people, but they themselves were thought to be under the dominion of God. But the dominion of God has gone the way of a lot of other things too, in large part. And so now, we're at the top of the heap. We are as God in the world, we men and women, see? So we act, as a society certainly. So he says, we've escaped any order that might imply restraints or impose limits. And so he says, we see ourselves as both creature and creator. And so he says, we set out to make paradise. What else? We're in charge now? We can get back to Eden, in effect. And so then he says, now, where do we get this? He says, there must have been some kind of a vision that was behind this. And what was it? It was the future. He says, the modern mind longs for the future as the medieval mind longed for heaven. Gordon Lightfoot has got a song, the Canadian Railroad Trilogy, where he talks about how when the railroad was built into Canada, you know, the men who envisioned that saw the railroad going through and opening the country up, you know, and everything, the goods would pour in. And everyone would benefit, and that's what's happened, and in a way the benefits have come, right? I mean, they've come. Here we sit in the middle of the mountains, sustained by this incredible culture. You know, we don't grow our own food here. We're living on the bounty. One of the oddest terms of phrase in our language is futuristic. Our obsession with security is a measure of the power we have granted the future to hold over us. You know, you asked about Christian connections. Elsewhere here, I made a little note. We pray, give us this day our daily bread. But we work as though we've got to try to plan for the next 50 years, or 20 years, or 10 years, or year. Which one of us is willing to live day by day? I mean, we want stores of energy. We want to stockpile oil, metal, gold, whatever it takes, right? We're obsessed with security.
Keith, that's like what John Tram said about praying for our daily bread. It's hard to pray for our daily bread when we own the bakery.
Yes. Yeah. But that's going to come to an end. He says, the automobile of the future. Well, that's kind of passé now because of the gas thing. The kitchen of the future. Well, I remember ads like that. The classroom of the future. Schools are in disrepute right now. Have long figured more actively in our imaginations, plans, and desires than whatever versions of these things we may currently have. Since we long ago gave up the wish to have things that were adequate or even excellent, we have preferred instead to have things that were up to date. It's really true. It says, the only possibility of satisfaction is to be driving now in one's future automobile.
Well, there is some truth to that.
Sure.
You don't want to have a car that has a good set of 75 miles per gallon, you know. We don't have,
okay.
We're not satisfied with that car we bought last year because
only gets
35.
One.
Yeah,
or an
electric
one.
Now, then he says, there's a paradox in here that we ignore. The future, so full of material blessings, is nevertheless threatened with dire shortages of food, energy, and security. True. Unless we exploit the earth even more freely, with greater speed and less caution. Haven't you heard this? Haven't you heard the oil companies in their ads saying, hey, don't tax us so much. We need that money to find more oil. Don't straitjacket us, you know. You want the energy, well, let us go find it for you. right?
Ore minerals.
Ore minerals, true. The future, so full of material blessings, is nevertheless threatened with dire shortages of food, energy, and security unless we exploit the earth even more freely, with greater speed and less caution. The obvious paradox is involved in this, that we are using up future necessities in order to make a more abundant future. See? That final loss has been made a calculated strategy of annual gain. It is as if the future is a newly discovered continent which the corporations are colonizing. We're colonizing the future, and the future has got no power to stop us. And he comes up to that theme time and again about how we... his next section is called Let Them Eat the Future. And it's based on an article in National Geographic by Mr. Jules Billard, which is kind of cute here. He says, Mr. Billard... during most of the article is in the grip of the ignorant awe, the greenhorn's ecstasy that has been as necessary to this revolution as the ball bearing, meaning the agricultural revolution. During his encounters with the various manifestations, this man is a senior editor of National Geographic, or at least was in the early 1970s. Mr. Billard marveled twice. He was staggered, fascinated, astounded, and jolted once each. He experienced two jolting awakenings, the second more jolting than the first, and once his mind churned. Those are all quotes. Here's his revolutionary wonders, he says. You can have strawberries in January, fresh oranges and lettuce the year round. Don't you just love the Safeway stores with their produce? I do. Of the 6,000, 8,000 items in the typical supermarket, 40% were not there a dozen years ago. Who can knock these things? In a single lifetime, U.S. agriculture has advanced more than in all the preceding millenniums of man's labor on the land. Barry just hates that one because he's talking about how erosion is becoming, again, a major problem in this country. Because we don't farm contours anymore. We plow the terraces. We eliminate the wind, the windbreaks.
We log it off, too.
Hmm?
We log it off, too.
Yes, sure. He says it's estimated that it takes 2 bushels of topsoil in Iowa right now to grow 1 bushel of corn. The loss of 2 bushels of soil by erosion to grow 1 bushel of corn in Iowa now. That just amazed me. I don't know where in the world he got that from, but it's really terrifying. He also says it takes 7 to 12 calories of fossil fuel energy to grow 1 calorie of corn energy. No? And the heat is lost. It just goes into the air. That's the entropy thing, It just goes into the air and it's lost. I handle tomatoes, bred for machine harvesting. Because only one person in 43 is needed to produce food. Others can become doctors, teachers, shoemakers, and janitors. Or unemployed. He doesn't say that. Today, 90% of the California tomato crop is picked mechanically. Meatless dishes tasting like chicken, beef, or ham.
Like what?
Chicken, beef, or ham.
Oh. Well, listen again.
Now he quotes an Iowa banker who says, in 1920, $5,000 was a big loan and people hesitated to borrow. Now a $40,000 loan is commonplace and having mortgage after mortgage is an accepted thing. I occasionally wonder whether the average farmer will ever get out of debt, unquote. Now he says, the Iowa banker's statement, doubtful as it may seem out of context, is made in praise of credit in this article. It's not a statement against credit, it's made in praise of credit. It was in this article that the Andersons are talked about, the people who now, are living in Freedom City, where they're trying to figure out what to do with these displaced workers, see? And then he says... it was at this point they have the farm of the future. Fields will be larger with fewer trees, hedges, and roadways. Machines will be bigger and more powerful. They'll be automated, even radio controlled, with closed-circuit TV to let an operator sitting on the front porch monitor what is going on. I don't know what the front porch will be on because obviously there won't be any houses on this land. So presumably it's the front porch of the control tower or something. I don't know. Weather control may tame hailstorms and tornado dangers, atomic energy from supply power to level hills, or provide irrigation water from the sea. It was at this point that Mr. Billard's, quote, mind churned with the implications of such developments building on the progress of the past, unquote. Gone are the fears of famine. Gone are any thoughts of displaced small farmers and farm workers, or of the threat of riots in the cities. See, earlier he mentioned that these people go into the cities and then they have a lot of trouble because they don't have anything to do and you get riots. But now he's forgotten all that. He says, Mr. Billard has risen right over apocalypse into heaven itself. He ends by quoting triumphantly a remark by a Brazilian official. Quote, by the Brazilian, we are concerned about the future of agriculture in Brazil. In your country, you are in the future. And he's, and Barry goes on to say, and so, of course, are the Andersons, with their 9 children, their one-room shanty, and no job, which ought to be reassuring to the people in the underdeveloped two-thirds of the world who are still trapped back there in the present. It's a very, very ironic stuff, you know. Well, there's a lot more there, but we're not going to have time to, you know, I have to stop or I'll just go on and on and on. Well, I think it's really important for us to not, you know, implore each other to be guilty. I said that before, but I want to say it again. He says that the difference is that it's been unthinkable that we could do anything different, you know? It's been unthinkable that people could farm with a mule and a horse. We have to begin to make it thinkable. We have to begin to imagine the possibility. It's not that you or I are going to do it, because probably we won't, although we might, some of us. But we have to begin to think of that possibility before it can be, you know, before it can be reality. And that is, you know, what we need to do. And so that's why he writes the book. And his quotation of the article in National Geographic and his extensive quotations. Well, see, Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture when the book was written. In his foreword, he says, I realize Mr. Butz isn't there anymore, but he's really representative. He quotes him and other men to show that our official policies have not changed. We're still going right down the road, more, bigger. And he said, you know, it's justified by saying we have to feed the millions. We've got to feed the hungry of the world. But in the same speech, our statements like only 5% of the food is used for this. To show that really it's a very profitable enterprise, see? So there's no, the ideas never get together. Or he says, we have to feed the millions, but in doing it we wreck the earth so that pretty soon all of us will be hungry, see? I mean, we never put the two together. And he's pleading with us to begin to make some connections so that we can see that what we're doing now has some effect on what's going to be done later, you know? Very challenging book. Okay.